So, this evening we want to introduce the Sri Brihad Bhagavatamrita, a book written by Srila Sanatana Goswami. Sanatana Goswami was one of the principal disciples of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And as we know, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu himself was none other than Krishna. He was directly Krishna. And Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu came to teach by example how to act as a devotee of the Lord. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu then instructed the two brothers, Rupa and Sanatana Goswami. And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu himself never wrote any books. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, rather, only produced 8 verses, right? And these 8 verses are known as the Sikshastakam. And these verses deal with the entire process of Krishna consciousness from the beginning stages, where it is described that there's a need to purify the heart, to the topmost stages, where the heart of the purified person who's absorbed in love of God. Then Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu instructed Rupa and Sanatana detailedly in the philosophy of Krishna consciousness. And after that, he ordered them to write books. So this Brihad Bhagavatamrita is one of the books which is the result of that endeavor. This is what Srila Prabhupada said about it. Anyone who wants to know about the subject matter of devotees, devotional service, and Krishna must read this book. His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, Founder Acharya of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. So Prabhupada was certainly gave a great endorsement about the Brihad Bhagavatamrita. It is therefore not just another book that has been translated among so many others, but we have to see this book is essential. And in this particular rendition, it's very nice because, first of all, there's the text which is written, and then there is also a commentary. The commentary written to the Brihad Bhagavatamrita was also written by Sanatana Goswami himself. It was called the Dik Darshini Tika. The Dik Darshini Tika, however, was never published together with the original text. It was just published in a separate book, and it was just notes in Sanskrit, like in sutra form. So now the devotees then translated this commentary in sutra form, which means in a very condensed form in notes, and wrote it in normal prose, right? Just made it into proper sentences, and then have put it together with the original verses. So in this way we get actual purports to the verses, which point for point are actually taken from Sanatana Goswami. So any of the points in the purports are actually Sanatana Goswami's points. So in that way, it makes the book especially interesting in this rendition, kind of a unique feature. Some endeavors have been made before to publish Brihad Bhagavatamrita, but it was never published in such a complete way, and therefore it is very nice. It also has the same format as in Srimad Bhagavatam and Bhagavad Gita, the original Sanskrit text in Devanagari, original Sanskrit text in English or Roman letters, next word for word, the verse, and the commentary. So like that, it is a very, very nice book. So I'll read something. I'll just read some translations just to get the storyline. Let me see, how big is this first chapter? All glories to that inconceivable Lord who descended to bestow the gift of perfect love for his own lotus feet. He's an ocean filled with many kinds of sweetness, and he always bears the fragrance of fresh youth. In his form, as Sri Chaitanya, he has realized the last extreme of transcendental experience, the love residing eternally in the gopis. All glories above all to the gopis headed by Sri Radhika, who are famous as the Lord's dearmost devotees. No one can ever begin to properly describe the charm of their supreme affection for Sri Hari. Realizing that the ecstasy of his beloved devotees is even sweeter than his own, out of greed the Lord descended to this world in the form of his own devotee. Dressed as a renunciant, golden in effulgence, he bears the name Sri Krishna Chaitanya. All glories to that Lord Hari, who has appeared as the son of Mother Sachi. All glories to Goddess Mathura Devi, the best of holy cities. She enchants the mind. She is most dear to the enemy of Kamsa, and she is adorned with the Lord's birthplace. The city of Mathura is acclaiming throughout the world for dispelling misery and bestowing liberation and devotion, not to mention the various pastimes the Lord has played here. All glories to this place where we are living, Lord Murari's Vrindavan Forest. He prefers residing here to residing in Vaikuntha or in the hearts of elevated saints. In Vrindavan, while always tending his cows, he gives pleasure to the gopis whose love for him in the mood of the rasa dance he increases by sweetly playing his flute. All glories to Sri Yamuna, the daughter of the sun god and sister of Yamaraj. She is beloved of Krishna, the killer of Mura. She has made friends with Mathura district and has exceeded the greatness of Ganga Devi. On the pretext of being a river, she carries the nectar flowing from Lord Sri Krishna's lotus feet. All glories to Govardhan, the emperor of lordly mountains. The Lord's dear gopis called him the best servant of Hari, Lord Krishna. Lord Krishna disrupted the sacrifice for worship of Indra to worship Govardhan instead, and then the hill resided for a week on the Lord's lotus palm. All glories to Sri Krishna Prema Bhakti, knowing that the feet of Prema Bhakti secretly comprise all the truth of the Vedas. Liberation herself has come to worship her. Indeed, liberation abandoned by the Vaishnavas has now given up her dependence on mantras, penance, sacrifice, and renunciation, and is eager to have the shelter of Prema Bhakti. All glories to Lord Murari in the form of his all-ecstatic name. If any living being puts aside such tasks as meditation, ritual worship, and social duties, and even once takes the Lord's holy name, the name will grant him liberation. That holy name is the greatest source of all eternal pleasure, and is my very life and ornament. I bow down to Sri Krishna Chandra, the bestower of unconditional mercy. In the modern age, he has appeared as Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu to distribute the taste of pure love. This book collects the essence of the scriptures, teaching devotional service rendered to the Supreme Lord. These essential teachings I have personally realized under the shelter of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. I received them from his dear devotee, Sri Rupa. May the Vaishnavas kindly hear this confidential scripture, Sri Bhagavat Amrita. Jaimini Rishi spoke it to King Janamejai in the enthusiasm of pure love. After Janamejai, the son of Parikshit, heard the wonderful Mahabharat recited by the great sage Jaimini, Janamejai was still eager to hear more, and so he inquired about the supplement to this epic. See, Janamejai said, O Brahmana, by hearing the Mahabharat from Vaisampayan, I never obtained the same relish I have now obtained by hearing from you. Please complete this recitation with perfect sweetness. So in the purport it's explained that the Mahabharat, or the ancient history of India, was not only spoken by Vyasadeva, who is also known as Vaisampayan, but that Actually, it was also spoken by other sages, and there were various Mahabharats, various versions, various testimonies of the same history of Bharat. So not only Vyasadeva produced the produced a version of Mahabharat, but Jaimini also produced. And that is what Janamejaya here. And he said that the sweetness of Jaimini's Mahabharat was more wonderful than the one of Vyasadeva, because the one of Jaimini was describing pure devotional service, right? Whereas the one of Vyasadeva is describing more the Karmakanda section. Some mixed. It is also there, devotional service, but not pure devotional service, like in Jaimini's rendition. Sri Jaimini said, by hearing the instructions of Sukadeva Goswami, Sriman Pariksit was relieved of all fear, all his ambition satisfied. He was absorbed in pure love for Sri Krishna. Now, as the time came near for the king to ascend to the destination he desired, his mother, Virata's daughter, a surrendered devotee of Krishna, approached him in great distress while he was alone. After Pariksit had consoled and pleased her by his greeting, she asked of him as follows, immersed in love for her son. Blessed Uttara said, my dear son, please extract the essence of what Sukadeva Goswami has taught you and quickly reveal it to me, as if churning the nectar of immortality from the ocean of milk. Sri Jaimini said, King Pariksit, feeling affection for his mother, answered her respectfully, eager to enjoy, recounting the wonderful narrations he had just heard about Lord Govinda. Sri Pariksit, known as Vishnu Ratha, said, mother, at a time like this, one should observe silence, but your delightful question impels me to speak. I shall speak by the mercy of my spiritual master, Sriman Badarayani, Sukadev Goswami. First, let me offer respects to our Lord and Master Sri Achyuta, who granted the gift of life to you and your son. His compassionate grace inspired the best of his pure devotees in the great effort to extract the nectar of Srimad Bhagavatam. The greatest sages have approved this resulting work, which is full of confidential truth. Please listen with attention as I faithfully repeat it to you. Once, a group of exalted sages were at Prayag, the best of pilgrimage sites, during the months of Magh. The sages had taken their bath and were happily seated before the deity of Sri Madhava, feeling satisfied, as if all their goals in life had been fulfilled. They were praising one another, saying, you are the recipient of Lord Krishna's mercy. Dear mother, at that time, a first-class brahmana arrived at that holy site called Dasashvamedha Tirtha. He was fully absorbed in devotional service to the Supreme Lord. Richly endowed with all assets, he was the spiritual leader of that region. His retinue surrounded him as he prepared to distribute food to the local brahmanas. So, before we continue, so it's very interesting, just to summarize it a little bit, that when Maharaj Pariksit was the emperor of the world, he was somehow or other cursed by this young brahmana boy to die within 7 days. At that time, Maharaj Pariksit sat down at the Ganges facing the north, and many sages assembled there along with him, and he was waiting for death to come. He knew he was cursed. He knew he would die within 7 days. And he would die from snake bite, the boy had said. So he knew that. But then Sukadeva Goswami came, and Sukadeva Goswami instructed him in the knowledge of Srimad Bhagavatam, and it was very, very wonderful. So it is said, after that, he was sitting silently in deep meditation on the Supreme Lord. And then his mother came. That's what is described here. His mother came, and his mother, she was just naturally distressed. Her son was about to die. How could she not be distressed? But yet she realized also that he was a great transcendental personality. But she came before him totally in anxiety, and she felt that, she realized that my son is leaving this world, and yet he is a great, great personality. He is totally absorbed in the knowledge of Krishna. But me, I'm just feeling totally affected by this, that my son is leaving. Therefore, let me take shelter of him and let me hear from him. So, let me hear from him about this transcendental knowledge that he has. And in this way, she went before her son, who then began to narrate this particular story, right, which we are beginning now. It is the essence of the Bhagavad, right? Which he, see, she wanted that he would tell the same essence that he had heard from Sukadev Goswami. But that took so many days, right? So how was it possible for him to repeat all that? That wasn't possible. So he was, then she said, all right, just give me the essence of what you learned. So then he began to speak about this Brihad Bhagavatamrita, which was giving the essence of Bhagavat, and it was also a narration he had heard from his spiritual master. Dear mother, at that time a first-class brahmana arrived at the holy site called Dasaswamedha Tirtha. He was fully absorbed in devotional service to the Supreme Lord. Having collected all sorts of valuable items for worship of the Lord, the generous brahmana then saw to the preliminaries, first by purifying a large area on the ground. Then he swiftly built a handsome altar, which he smeared with mud with his own hands and covered it with a canopy. Next, he placed Lord Krishna's form as the Shaligram Shila on an auspicious golden throne and worshipped the Lord with great devotion. Joyfully, he performed the prescribed rituals. In front of Lord Hari, he placed food, clothes, and other offerings. He made a one-man festival by dancing, singing, playing music, and so on. He then offered homage to the brahmanas present, who were expert in arguing from the Vedas, Puranas, and other texts. He also offered respects to the sannyasis, householders, and brahmacharis. And he honored the Vaishnavas, who were always greedy, to enjoy the bliss of glorifying Krishna. Thus, he encouraged the many respectable persons there with attractive words and behavior. After placing on his head the water that had washed their feet, he worshipped those persons with the food and other items he had presented to the Supreme Lord. Next, he respectfully fed everyone else, including the most fallen outcasts. In suitable ways, he satisfied even the dogs, jackals, birds, and insects. When he had thus satisfied everyone, the holy man invited him to take the remnants of the sacrifice with his family and followers, that leader of brahmanas, then enjoyed the nectarian prasad with great delight. After this, he again went before the Shaligram deity of Lord Krishna, and with folded hands, he offered to the Lord all the pious credit he had earned by the sacrifice. The leader of the brahmanas put the deity comfortably to rest and got ready to return home. Sri Narada, however, had been watching him at a distance from within the assembly of sages. Just then Narada stood up. Again and again, Narada announced, "This is the Supreme Lord Vishnu's most dear devotee." Then he ran up to the brahmana and declared him the recipient of Lord Krishna's highest mercy. Narada proclaimed this openly to all, beside himself with eagerness for devotional service to Lord Krishna. Sri Narada said, "O leader of the brahmanas, it is you who have received Lord Krishna's greatest favor. After all, you have such wealth, prosperity, generosity, and personal opulence. O wise one, in the best of holy places, we have now seen for ourselves that you are using all these assets exclusively to establish pure religion." That most learned brahmana then replied to the best of sages, O Master, what signs of Krishna's mercy have you seen in me? Who am I but a most wretched person? How much charity am I able to give? What opulence do I have? And how have I ever reciprocated with the Lord in devotional service? But in the southern country, there lives a great ruler, whose kingdom has many temples of God and the demigods. He is the true recipient of Lord Krishna's mercy. Saintly mendicants come to his kingdom from all directions, along with pilgrims and other visitors. They wander happily, sustained by food that has been offered to Krishna. Near this king's palace, the personality of Godhead resides, as if directly in his original form of eternal existence, knowledge and bliss. He is kindly assumed a non-moving appearance. In that kingdom, a joyous, ever-fresh festival is always being celebrated. At each moment, there are new offerings and performances of worship. The king respectfully feeds all the residents of his country and the many foreign visitors with the remnants of Lord Vishnu's worship. Saintly devotees of Lord Vishnu come from various countries to reside permanently in the kingdom. They come out of eagerness to see the lotus-eyed deity of the Lord, to relish the food and other special remnants from the Lord, and to obtain the association of spiritually advanced persons. The king has given his kingdom away to the demigods and brahmanas, dividing it among them. His kingdom is completely free from sorrow, social disruption, and fear. In that kingdom, the earth yields crops without being tilled. Rain falls just enough for people's comfort, and whatever fruits, vegetables, and clothing one desires are easily to be had. The citizens all happily follow the king as if they were his children. They perform their own social duties and are devoted to Lord Krishna. The king is always prideless, worshipping Lord Achyuta, with services as a menial servant would perform. He pleases all the people and is dear to the Lord. So, we see that the Brahmana was being glorified by Narada Muni. Narada Muni stood up and called out the glories of the Brahmana and said, "You are the greatest devotee. You, indeed, are the greatest recipient of the mercy of the Lord, because everything you have, you are using it in the service of Krishna." So, that is a very good reason to consider that such a person is the greatest recipient. But that Brahmana himself said, "No, what sign of Krishna's mercy have you seen in me? I am wretched, I am fallen." And he pointed to someone else. He said, "There's a king in South India. He is the one, not me. Look at him. Compare what I've done and look what he is doing. He's so much greater than me." And in this way, the Brahmana was, first of all, he was making his own achievements insignificant. He wasn't saying, "Yes, I've done great things." No. He wasn't saying, "Well, it's nice that you are recognizing, you know, there are so few who understand my glories." He was not saying anything like that. Rather, he said, "No, it's nothing what I'm doing. It's insignificant." You know what I mean? Although what he really did was significant, was quite something. So he took a very humble position and then logically began to explain why the other person was much better. He said, "Yes, this king is much greater than me. I do a little worship here on a small little altar. What does it mean? This king is maintaining many temples. He's maintaining a whole country in Krishna consciousness. I am here making a little contribution. I'm doing a little puja with a handful of people. Right? But now look at this king. This king is single-handedly maintaining a whole country in Krishna consciousness. All the citizens, all the pilgrims, everyone is Krishna conscious. So how much greater he is than me? Therefore go there. If you want to see one who has the mercy of Krishna, it is this king. It's not me. I am just a beggar begging for the mercy of the Lord, doing a little puja." That was the mood of the Brahmana. And we see how he continues to glorify that king. He always tries to satisfy the Lord. He himself performs sankirtan before the Lord's deity, chanting the Lord's names, composed in various attractive arrangements. He dances, sings wonderful songs, and plays instruments. His sons, wives, brothers, grandsons, priests, servants, ministers, and other subordinates. He has them also take part. So it really looks like the king is greater, because he affects more people, right? So it really looks like he got more mercy of the Lord, because he has the ability to affect so many more people compared to the Brahmana. Therefore, it seems that he's a greater instrument of the mercy of the Lord than that Brahmana. So therefore, indeed, it seemed that the king was the greater recipient of the mercy of the Lord. So it is very interesting that here, the point in the search of Narada is searching out for the person who has received the greatest mercy of the Lord. He who is the greatest recipient of the mercy of the Lord. So that's interesting, right? And in the cause of it, we get a description of what the symptoms are of one who is a recipient of the mercy of the Lord. It begins to show that in a person who is the recipient of the mercy of the Lord, that there are many good qualities manifesting in that person. And that that person is a pure devotee of the Lord. And that such a person is becoming an instrument of the mercy of the Lord. It's not just that he receives the instrument, that he receives the mercy of the Lord, and that it stops there. The greatest recipient of the mercy of the Lord is acting as a via media and is passing on that mercy to others. He becomes a channel of mercy to so many others. That is what we are seeing. And in this way we see that the king is judged to be the greater recipient of the mercy of the Lord because he is reaching a greater area. It is said just like you have a king, and there are different titles for different kinds of rulers. An ordinary king of a small country is addressed as Maharaj. But then a ruler who is the ruler of many countries, he is addressed as Chakravarti. Chakra means circle. And it means one whose influence is spread out to a big circle, a big area, Chakravarti. And one who is a ruler of the entire world, his title is known as Sarvabhauma. Sarva means all, and Bhauma means earth. So he is the ruler of the whole earth. So in this way, these titles are also given to devotees. Sometimes they're given to kings, and sometimes they're given to devotees. So also according to the influence that a devotee has. Maharaj means he has an influence in a particular area, and therefore the title can be given to a sannyasi, and to a king both. But then, if one has more influence in many, many areas, right, then the title Chakravarti is given, like Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, right, who is known as one of our acharyas. And then we have Sarvabhauma, one who is so influential that the whole world looks at him. Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya. One of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's associates was such a scholar that Sarvabhauma was his title. Because no one like him in the world, unique in the world in his scholarship, Sarvabhauma. There's only one in the whole world, Sarvabhauma. Right? Therefore, Sarvabhauma. So it is nice, like that, we are learning from Sanatan Goswami. So Narada is looking for the person who is the greatest recipient of the mercy of the Lord. So Narada is very intelligent. He's really looking for the right person. I mean, we're all looking for someone, right? Who are we looking for? Some people are trying to make a connection with the most famous person. Some people are trying to make a connection with the most beautiful person, right? Some people are trying to make a connection with the most wealthy person, the most powerful person. Or some are trying to make a connection with the most renounced person, right? Yes, it's amazing, right? If one gives up the world, right, and one gives up the the opposite sex, right, then one becomes very attractive for the opposite sex. It's sort of like a challenge, no? So, and also, some are looking for knowledge, for those who have knowledge. So in this way, we are looking for various opulences in this world, and we're looking for that in a different person. But Narada is not looking to make a connection with a rich person. Oh, yes, can I meet this very wealthy man? Oh, yes, very nice, yes, I'll be there. And we'll say, yes, sir, of course. We laugh at his jokes, ha, ha, ha. We are totally ready to flatter him any moment. Yes, very funny. Oh, yes, very nice. Oh, beautiful, your taste, yes, fantastic. Oh, yes, your dog, I love your dog. I love everything you have. I love it too much. Yes, I love it, I love it, I love it. Especially love your money, right? So, but no, Narada is not interested. Narada is not looking for the most beautiful girl. He's not looking at the whole world. Where is she? My goddess of fortune. Oh, yes. He's not looking. No, he's not looking for that. Narada is looking for the one who got the greatest mercy of the Lord. He's not even looking for the Lord. He's looking for one who got the greatest mercy. Because he knows that through the pure devotee of the Lord, one can get the mercy of the Lord. He knows. If one simply satisfies the pure devotee of the Lord, then the Lord will bestow his mercy. Therefore, Narada was looking for the most wonderful and most important thing. So, it is said, Narada then went to the country of that best of kings to see him. Wherever Narada went, he found the people absorbed in festive worship of the Lord. Narada arrived at the capital, vibrating his veena with delight. Seeing even greater splendor than the Brahmana had described, he approached the king and spoke. Sri Narada said, "You are the real recipient of Sri Krishna's mercy. After all, your kingdom is so opulent. It has the best citizens endowed with the most excellent character, religiousness, prosperity, knowledge, and devotion to God." Sri Pariksit said, "Narada, the best of Vaishnavas, singing along with his veena, thus expansively described the king, praising his greatness, and Narada embraced him again and again. The king, that ruler of a vast region, then worshipped the topmost sage and humbly replied, his head bowed down in embarrassment by the weight of hearing his own praise." Nice poetry also, this last verse. It said, his head bowed down in embarrassment by the weight of hearing his own praise. This is nice poetry. In the previous two verses, there is the description of how the kingdom is so opulent. Narada is glorifying the king and is saying, you are the real recipient of Krishna's mercy because your kingdom is so opulent. Right? And then he says how best citizens, excellent character, religiousness, prosperity, knowledge, devotion to God, and all these things. So it means that Narada is judging the mercy of the Lord that is being received by the king by the opulence in his kingdom and by the nature of the citizens in the kingdom. That the citizens are very pious, religious, etc. Therefore, he's saying he can see that the blessings of the Lord are upon a person. So the qualities that manifest in a particular person are the manifestation that the mercy of the Lord is there upon a particular person. That is one of the points that I made in the purports. Today I'm not reading the purports to you, I'm just reading the texts because I thought I'll give you the storyline, but I've read the purports, so I'm remembering something as I'm reading. So I'm giving some comments that are relating to the purports as much as I remember. I mean, I may not verbatim remember, but to give you an idea. And that point was made that one can understand a recipient of the mercy of the Lord by how much the Lord has given him qualities and facilities to be used in the service of the Lord. See? So like that, that is a very important point. A very important point. So anyway, the king, right, hearing his own praise, was feeling embarrassed. So this is important. That when we are being praised, that we are not developing this thing. Yes, finally somebody who is a little bit intelligent. After all this time, I was just wondering, is there anyone in this world who could possibly recognize my glories? Right. But no, the king, although being glorified and worshipped, bowed down in embarrassment. The king said, O sage among the demigods, I am a human being with a short lifespan, little opulence and little to give others. I have no independence. I am constantly attacked by fear and ruled by the threefold miseries of material life. I would not even deserve Krishna's word that in the future he might show me his mercy. Why do you wrongly consider me an object of his compassion? The demigods are the real objects of the Supreme Lord Vishnu's mercy. They have effulgent bodies and always worshipable by men. They are sinless, fixed in goodness, free from distress, and always happy. They act and travel however they like. They give their blessings by granting what their devotees desire. So here the king continues the same line of reasoning that Narada was displaying. Narada was explaining that the opulence and the piety of the citizens and of the kingdom were a symptom that the king had received the mercy of the Lord. So now the king is arguing along the same reason, said, look, you know, what I've got is just a drop of that. But look at the demigods that are living on the higher planetary systems. They have so much of that. The Supreme Lord has given them so much opulence. Compared to that, I have nothing. Right? So again, he was pointing, when he was being glorified, he denied it, and then he logically pointed out others who indeed were superior to him in that aspect. Right? So therefore he logically said, no, it's not me, others. Right? And then we see that the king continues, so we'll read a little more. Their food is the nectar of immortality, which does away with such miseries as death, disease, and old age. Though not forced by hunger or thirst, the demigods enjoy great satisfaction in partaking of this nectar by their own sweet will. O godly Narada. So that's an interesting detail we never knew. It says that the demigods are not forced by hunger and thirst. They just eat for pleasure. That's interesting. That's an interesting detail. We never knew that. See the opulence of the demigods. God, we just, you know, all day long we're starving, right? And so forth. And then we have to eat again. And then we've done it again. And then, you know, like I said, why did I do it? Why did I do it? And then we're starving again. And we do it again. And we're just wondering, you know, in this constant cycle of doing it and having done it, you know, and wondering why. Right? This is the ongoing process. But the demigods, they are not caught up in this. They just eat for pleasure. O godly Narada, on the strength of their good fortune, they live in the realm of heaven, which humans on the earth can attain only by perfect pious work. My dear sage, the most distinguished of these demigods is Purandar Indra. He has full power to reward and punish, and he gives the world life by providing rain. He rules the three planetary systems for 71 celestial ages, a length of sovereignty no mundane king could earn. even by 100 horse sacrifices. It is said that if you perform 100 horse sacrifices, then you become eligible to get the position of Indra. We remember in Srimad Bhagavatam that Maharaj Prithu had performed 99 and that Indra was getting very worried. Oh my God, it's almost 100 now, and that Indra stole the horse in the sacrificial fire. So it is a whole thing, because this Ashvamedha Yajna, you have to send the horse out into the world and let it roam wherever it is, right? And then, at a later stage, the horse is then, after its long journey, then it is offered in a fire sacrifice, and the brahmanas are reviving that horse, and he attains a younger body. So an Ashvamedha Yajna is no joke, right? First you have to send this horse anywhere, and it has to go its path obstructed. If any king stops the horse, then you have to fight with that king. Right? That's all part of the Ashvamedha Yajna. So 100 Ashvamedha Yajnas means like you've conquered the whole world practically. There's no doubt about it. It's not just doing 100 horse sacrifices. Okay, bring the horses, you know, boys. Okay, bring them in. Yep, stoke up the fire. Okay, it's a big fire. Okay, there you go, horsey. Okay, hut, hut, hut. Come on. Right, okay, job done, right? 95, only 5 more to go, right? It's not so easy. It's a little tougher than that. You have to send the horse into the world, and then any king who stops that horse is challenging you. Then you have to fight with that king. No joke, right? And the king may use his army too. You have to use yours. So it's like it's a whole thing, you know. You have to conquer the whole world. And then you have to, of course, establish the worship of Supreme Lord. There's so many rules to perform this Ashvamedha Yajna. Very complex. So, therefore, 100 Ashvamedha Yajna is impossible to do. But if you do, you can become Indra. Indra, Indra, Indra. Isn't it? I learned that from Paravita when I was staying next door to your room in Antwerp, rehearsing the play. Indra! Oh, Indra! He had all the kids in calling out, Indra, Indra, oh, Indra. Huh? How was it, Paravita? Please, give us a little demonstration. Now, whoever, tell us who it is. I heard it through the wall. Okay, can you say it? There was much more, you know. That was a whole thing. Went on for 15 minutes. In that garden, so we're going, oh, sorry, I missed one verse. Utsai Shrava is his horse, Indra's horse, and Airavata is his mighty elephant. His cow can be milked for any desire. In his garden is the resplendent Nandana. In that garden are desire trees like the Parijata, whose flowers yield whatever one may wish. Those trees, adorned with desire-yielding creepers, assume whatever forms one may like. Even a single flower from those trees can fully satisfy one's desires, whether for wonderful songs and music, splendid dances, bright clothing and ornaments, good food, or anything else. And oh, how can I even describe Indra's great fortune? The Supreme Personality of Godhead, Vishnu, has taken the form of Vamanadeva and has become his younger brother. Lord Vamanadeva encourages Indra by shielding him from dangers and by accepting in person the elaborate worship Indra offers. But of course, you already know this and much more. So, this is the end of the first chapter. Right? So this first chapter is called Bhoma, or it deals on the earth. The second chapter is called Divya, in heaven. The third chapter is called Prapanchatita, beyond the material world. The fourth chapter is called Bhakta, the devotee. Fifth, Priya, the beloved. Sixth is called Priyatama, the most beloved. in the seventh chapter is called Purna, the complete perfection. So we can understand that here in this first chapter, first Narada went to that Brahmana, was very impressed, was sent by the Brahmana to the king, and then is sent to the heavenly planets. And we can understand that Narada is going to encounter many more personalities, and at each time he will think that now I found the person who received the most mercy of the Lord, and then that person again explains, I'm nothing, look at him. And in this way he moves on and on and on until he finally, and finally there is a description where Narada is coming to Dwarka. Right? He's coming to Dwarka. And he's coming to Dwarka to meet Uddhava, because he has heard that Uddhava had heard from the gopis, right, of Vrindavan, when they were experiencing the most intense moments of attachment to Krishna, when they were separated from Krishna. It is said that when we feel love for someone, that when he's in our presence, or she's in our presence, whatever, when that person's in our presence, then the love is there. But when the person leaves us, then certainly that feeling becomes so strong and it just burns then. So many stories of, like, you know, when the princess leaves or dies, the prince is just there, you know, cannot eat anymore, cannot see anything anymore, cannot talk anymore. This kind of the separation. So separation is the most intense experience. So when the gopis were with Krishna, their attachment for Krishna was extraordinary. So much so. And Krishna danced with them in the dead of night in the forest of Vrindavan. And then Krishna left, and the emotions of the gopis increased many, many fold. And at that time, they were in great separation, waiting for Krishna to return, but he was not. And then, still hoping against hope, one day Krishna sent Uddhava. Now Uddhava was a cousin of Krishna, and he resembled Krishna very, very much. Right? So in the seventh chapter of Brihad Bhagavatamrita, it is described that Uddhava, he went to Vrindavan, he heard from the gopis while they were in this mood of separation, and Narada knew about this. So Narada wanted to meet Uddhava, because he wanted to hear from Uddhava what he had heard at that time in Vrindavan. That's what he wanted to hear, because he could understand that at that moment there was the greatest reciprocation of mercy going on. So he wanted to hear from Uddhava. And he was so ecstatic that he got lost when he entered Dwarka. He didn't know where he was. And he was just walking left and right, totally intoxicated in love of God. But because in Dwarka, there are 16,108 palaces where Krishna lives, therefore, although he wandered anywhere and everywhere in his love of God, in his ecstasy, totally lost the way, he just wound up in Krishna's palace. Since there are 16,108, he couldn't miss him. And he walked in, and there, sure enough, there was Krishna. And in that way, Narada came in. Well, actually, Krishna was in the palace, but he was not in the room where Narada came. But Narada at that time was looking for Uddhava. So he said, where is Uddhava? Uddhava, where is Uddhava? And he was so ecstatic, and everyone was quite happy to see Narada. But at the same time, when he began to ask for Uddhava, and then he asked that Uddhava, he wanted to hear from Uddhava about the gopis of Vrindavan. Then everyone said, shh, because Krishna is remembering. Krishna, it is Krishna. Don't talk of this. And Narada could not understand what are they trying to do, you know. He was ecstatic, he wanted to hear, and now they're telling him, shh, you know. So Narada just couldn't be controlled. He asked anyway. So this is the theme of the seventh chapter. Now what is turning out, that after a little while, we're finding out that Krishna is lying there on bed. He's not well that day. He didn't get up, right? And it takes, so Krishna's not well. Krishna has a headache. He has a terrible headache, and he's just lying there, and there's no way Krishna's going to get up that day. So, you know, but after a little while it comes out that actually Krishna doesn't have a headache, but that Krishna is just didn't get up because he is thinking of the gopis of Vrindavan. He does, it is said that Krishna actually is always remembering the gopis in Vrindavan. Satyabhama is speaking, and Satyabhama says that even at night, in his sleep, Rukmini who's speaking, said, even in his sleep, Krishna is talking about Vrindavan. He's only talking about Vrindavan. And although he is with us, he's only talking about Vrindavan. And Satyabhama says, why don't you speak the truth, Rukmini? Speak the truth! Right? Because Satyabhama is a heavy character, right? So she comes out, you know, like she's somewhat hot-tempered. So she says, like, it's not like that at all. You know, this is total nonsense. You know, why don't you just tell it as it is? I will tell it as it is. Right? It's not only in his sleep. It's even during the day. It's just always. He's just thinking of the residents of Vrindavan. He doesn't care about us at all. Not at all. He's only thinking of them. Right? Actually, like that she's speaking. Anyway, so it gradually comes out that Krishna is just lying on the bed and is just remembering the residents of Vrindavan, and that this particular day, it was a very bad streak of remembrance, and that's why he didn't get up. So, you know, everyone is kind of wondering what to do about it, etc. And some are saying, well, why doesn't Krishna just go to Vrindavan? And then Padmavati, Padmavati is the mother of Kamsa, right? So Padmavati, she says, like, well, you know, like, why would he go to Vrindavan, you know? Like, they will just exploit him, you know? Can you imagine how cruel they were? Then he was just a little boy, and they sent him out in the forest, and he had to be out there all day herding those cows in that horrible forest, that dangerous jungle, full of sharp thorns and terrible animals, etc. How cruel are these cowherd men to send a little child into the forest? So, like that, Padmavati is like just hopeless, you know, and just talking gibberish, and all the other members present are just saying, oh, come on, shut up, Padmavati, just, you know, shut up and go back off to your own corner, you know, give us a break, you know. I mean, at this time, we really don't want to hear this kind of nonsense, right? So, like that, right, like that, it is continuing. Then, in the midst of it all, Lord Brahma appears. Because Lord Brahma is worried. Because Lord Brahma, he wants paritranaya sadhanam vinasya suduskritam dharma samstarpanatya sambhavami yuge yuge. He wants that the principles of religion are being established within the universe and that the demons are being annihilated. And when that's not going on, then the order of the universe is not properly taking place. So Lord Brahma comes and he says, what's happening? Here is our Supreme Lord, and he's lying here in remembrance of the residents of Vrindavan. He's not active. We have to do something about it. So therefore, Lord Brahma had a plan. And the plan was that he arranged for Viswakarma to make a copy of Vrindavan, and then they would take Krishna off the bed to this copy of Vrindavan. So then Rohini, she's both in Vrindavan and in Dwarka, she could be there, and Balaram could be there, but nobody else could be there because they were all from Dwarka. So all the others were hiding. Anyway, so Rohini took Krishna there, said, let's go, let's meet your mother Yasoda. So Vishwakarma had even made perfect statues of the residents of Vrindavan. So there was a statue of Mother Yasoda. And this statue, the statue of Mother Yasoda just looked like Mother Yasoda, and she had some yogurt in her hand. So But she was standing there, non-moving, just in a frozen position. Anyway, sometimes it did happen that Mother Yasoda was getting ecstatic symptoms upon seeing Krishna and was becoming frozen on the spot, that she was getting stunned. So Krishna wasn't thinking, okay, she must be like that. So he just snatched the yogurt, and then Rohini said, come, your mother is not so well. You come with us to the forest. We'll send you a picnic for breakfast today. So Krishna went to the forest like that. And then... But as he was wandering in the forest along with Balaram, who was waiting for him at the edge, and they came into the forest and they walked along, then suddenly Krishna saw the ocean. Ocean? Forest? This is not Vrindavan, right? And Krishna suddenly realized he got cheated and tricked. Right? And at that time all the others revealed themselves. But anyway, Krishna was kind of out his depression. He was up from the bed, you know. Once you cut him up from the bed, you know how it is. Gets back into action. So, like that, Krishna then was kind of back in an active mood. And then there was a little talk after that. And Krishna was... when he heard what had been said, because he had said, yes, he had... heard it all. He said, although he was lying on the bed, he had heard the entire conversation, you know. And he had heard when Rukmini spoke about the dream. He had heard when Satyabhama spoke. And Krishna said, yes, it is all true. It is all true. He said, do you know why I married 16,108 queens? He said, because there are 16,108 gopis, so at least they remind me of the gopis. Can't imagine how the queens must have felt. But anyway, all this is described in the Brihad Bhagavatamrita and so much more. So it's very interesting. And the second part of this is the first part. The second part of the book describes Gopakumar. The coward boy Gopakumar, who is also looking for perfection and for the most perfect manifestation of the Supreme Lord, and who goes through different worlds and different places. He'll go to Vaikuntha, he'll go to Ayodhya, he'll finally go to Golok after having been in so many places. So, this narration of the Brihad Bhagavatamrita is showing us the path of perfection, right? And is therefore, it is the summarized essence of Srimad Bhagavatam. In a playful way, it gives us different levels of devotion and different levels of surrender to Krishna, and then different levels of perfection that may be attained by performing various processes. So in a very playful way, it takes us through the whole philosophy of Krishna consciousness. At the end of the book, Gopakumar is finally going back to Godhead. And in Krishna consciousness, generally that's where the book ends, you know, like in a fairy tale, the end is, and they lived long, happily ever after, right? In some sort of thriller, at the end they catch the murderer or something like that. So there are these classical endings in a book, and generally in Krishna consciousness it ends with going back to Godhead. But it's very interesting that in the Brihad Bhagavatamrita, in the final chapter, Gopakumar is going back to Godhead, and then he arrives. He arrives there. And then what happens when he arrives in the spiritual world? So this is very, very interesting. Therefore, these books we may relish and read with great pleasure. Unfortunately, as it is, they're not all published because all that we have is part one. So part one is those first seven chapters, The Search of Narada, that you can read. But The Search of Gopakumar, sorry, can't read that. No. Oh, you can read some awkward translations in the computer upstairs, or some printouts, or some Kusakrata translation, which is nice, but no, with all due respect, but quick done, you know, not very
careful and exact, right? That we know. But a full translation with the purports and essence that you can't get, because before they can print part two, all the part ones have to be sold. And they haven't been sold yet. Now, it happens to be that here in this temple there are a few for sale, isn't it? And they haven't been sold yet. So maybe some of you would like to buy. They're very cheap. Gauranga, how much are you selling them for? 34? 34 euros. So much. Gee. You guys are making a lot of profit. I sell them for a lot cheaper in South Africa. Anyway, 34 in Holland. What is 34? You know, it's nothing. So 34 for such a wonderful book. First of all, you get a great book, and by buying it, part two will also be printed because it's already translated. So tonight they'll be for sale, and hey. Okay, there's three left. That's the books will be sold for 30, but you have to give 4 euros donation for 4 Gauranga's preaching mission. Yes.
In general, as I understand, well, it's better not to act above one's level of realization. How is it with humility? If one is not really humble inside, is it still better to act humble? How is that?
Mm-hmm.
It looks like one might act in a false state, but on the other end,
acting above one's realization. Acting above one's realization is, it means that one should not try to experience higher devotional sentiments than one has. Right? One should not go in front of the deity and try and feel love for Krishna if he doesn't have. Yeah. One should not artificially, I love Krishna so much, right? Love. See, this doesn't work. Just like one can say, we must love our neighbor, right? We must love our fellow man, right? But you cannot love your fellow man by declaration. You cannot just say, let us love our fellow man. You don't, you know. We don't love our fellow man at all. We don't love him. Forget it. Right? You can say, let's love him. But we don't. We don't. Some a little bit, and some a little less, and some we don't love at all. Right? It takes a little more than a declaration, obviously. It takes practice. It takes a whole change of mood before we love. We really love our fellow man. That's no joke. That is required? Yes. Yeah. So we're not here attacking another religion or something. We're just saying that it's not so cheap. Yes, we must love all our fellow men, but it's not just a declaration. It has to be realized. So this is what we're talking about in Krishna consciousness. Don't act as if you're on a higher platform than you are. If we all start walking around, you know, in the mood that we love everybody, you know, I love all my fellow, and we don't, then it's all ridiculous, right? We're making a fool of ourselves. I'm coming back to the humility, don't you worry. I'm first establishing a principle with an example. But when it comes to the prerequisites, right, to come to that loving propensity, to develop that loving propensity for Krishna and all living beings, when it comes to the prerequisites for that, then we have to, first of all, accept to restrict our tendencies. Right? We have many, many tendencies within ourselves that are not favorable for developing this mood of loving the Supreme Lord and all living beings. Right? So,
pride is one of these obstacles. Dishonesty is one of these obstacles. Hate is one of these obstacles, and so forth. Greed, right? Lust, right? So all these have to be conquered, right? So therefore, one conquers pride in two ways. One is just by serving Krishna and the devotees, and chanting Hare Krishna is one of them. And the other way is by acting out the good quality already, although we do not really have it, right? In other words, acting out the role of a humble person, although we are not humble, because in that way we don't give new fuel to our pride. Each time when I act proud, right, and I'm indulging in my pride, I put a little more pride on top of my pride, right? And then, you know, I'm so proud of all my achievements and I'm just indulging in it and I'm placing a little more pride on top of my pride and I'm building a skyscraper bigger than the greatest towers that we've ever seen in the world. And what will happen to me? The same like all the towers, right? What goes up must come down, right? So, therefore, by taking the humble position, we stop putting more, another layer on top of our pride. Right? So that helps. Then the pride may still stay, right? But then the process of devotional service will diminish that remainder of the pride. Because all these qualities that are described as virtues, such as honesty, knowledge, religiousness, wisdom, tolerance, austerity, right? All these kind of qualities, right? Freedom from envy, right? Freedom from lust, greed, angers, madness, illusion, and all these, right? All these kind of good qualities are preliminaries, right? For the cultivation of such good qualities are preliminaries that help us to come closer to developing love for God and all living beings and His entire creation. You see? So it all leads up to that. Yeah. So when you speak about going beyond your level, then you talk about acting as if you have more love than you really have. That's actually what that means. No. That's not what I said. I said that all these other things are preliminaries. To go for a quality of humility is a preliminary. It is an activity which you have to do to create a favorable condition where it's tilling the field so that the seed of love of God can grow. You see, it has nothing to do with the emotion. It is simply a technique, tilling the field.
For instance, if you might have an adverse feeling for a certain person, is it then...
That's hate.
Yeah, well, it could be that there is still some remains of that.
Yeah, that's hate.
Is it then better not to maybe engage with that person?
No.
Or is it better try to artificially show some love?
Not show some love, service. Service, not love. Service. Service. Don't ever show artificial love. Show service. Love is the one thing you should not artificially display. But if you have hate, control your hate and serve. And you will conquer it. And then love will manifest. And that's an example, I understand. All of us have some hate for somebody or something. Hate it. I really hate it. I hate football fans. If I'm on a train with a bunch of football fans, I hate it. I really hate it. You know? Can't stand it. Hate it. Is a novel? Yeah.
So, are Krishna's pastimes which are described there, are they real?
Yes, yes, they're real, and it's not a novel in that sense, you know, that it's like, I guess it's a whoever called it a novel is using a modern term on an ancient scripture, right, and trying to categorize it according to our modern divisions. So it's a narrative description of particular pastimes, right, and it is describing various matters. But what is being described here about Narada Muni is not fiction. It's fact. Right? This is actually... Yes, yes, yes. This is actually fact. This is not a new creation. It is a fact. It's an ancient story that is being told here about Narada. So it's not that... this is not Sanatana Goswami. This is an ancient story. I don't know, maybe because of part two, you know, I mean, I don't know why they call it a novel, because that's them, ask them, you know, like, now I don't know why they categorize it like a novel, I've heard that, but, huh? No, I understand, because it's a narrative, the story, but it's not fiction, that's the point. The book itself, if you read it, in the first chapter, explains that this is a historical narration. Actually, so it's an historical novel. Yeah.
And you're describing the difference between meeting and separation. Meeting is ecstasy, and then separation becomes even greater.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, if one is separated, one always looks for meeting.
Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. Right. No. Yeah. Then. It's not what the scriptures say. The scriptures say that that separation, meeting and separation, are both two faces of inner relationship, and that enhance one another, and that both are there. And that within a relationship, the separation is a means to increase the experience, yeah. And that then meeting is also there. Anyway, this in relation to Krishna, these are very intimate matters. We can discuss them another time. What are you talking about? No, it's not. No. Yes, so he's doing that. So it's the essence of the philosophy of Srimad Bhagavatam. It's not that it's a summary of Srimad Bhagavatam, but it's the essence of the philosophy.
So you're describing that Krishna is hankering for Vrindavan.
Yeah, but I don't want to describe it so much now. Are you sure? Yeah. I didn't find the last one so suitable for an open forum. Okay.
So then my question is, what is he doing in Vrindavan? Why in Dwarka? What is he doing in Dwarka? He's hanging for Vrindavan.
Yeah. Yeah, it's also explained in that seventh chapter. Yeah. No, but I find it gets too much into that aspect now. I mean, I'd rather speak about the first chapter. Yeah.
It was explained that if one has a lot of facility, it's also, or as we said there, it's also a sign of the Lord's mercy.
Yeah, that's said there. Yeah. Who? Well, there is something. So we see in this world, we see so many people with so much riches and so much facility. Of course, it's not just ordinary facility, right? It is also said particularly piety, right? The kings was pious facilities, not just facilities, but pious facilities. There were pious citizens, and there was a lot of pious attributes. Yeah? Like Prabhupada is saying about the West compared to India. And he's looking at the two, and we say the West, you know, like it's just more there's more progress in the West than in India, in one sense, materially, right? But Prabhupada said, you call that progress? That's not progress, right? You show me how it's progress, right? It's not progress. Because have they solved any of the problems of life? Have they really solved, right? Not really, not really. Still so many diseases are there. Still there is so many problems out there. It is just simply covered in another way. But the same problems of life are still there. People are not any happier. People are just... There's still so much suffering. And sometimes it is said that the simplicity of the residents of India, right, of living on an economic level which is not so developed, is the protection of Krishna, who protects the residents of India from falling into so many degraded activities. Whereas the Westerner has so much facility, etc., but he's using it all for sinful activity, and the result will be he'll go to hell. Right? Whereas the Indian people, they can't, right? Because they don't have all that. So they won't go to hell also. Yeah? So in one sense, who's in the better position? Krishna is protecting them. Prabhupada explains like that. Yes. So we can see that the asuras, they have facility, but they don't use anything in the worship for Krishna, you know, in the worship of God. They don't use all that facility for self-realization. So they have it for a while, and then they'll suffer. Right? So that's not what it meant here. It meant in relation to piety and in relation to worship of the Lord.
It is also said that by offensive tongue, people can become devotees. Yeah.
Well, if we approach Krishna, and instead of approaching Krishna, we become offensive to Krishna, then we are actually approaching Krishna in a materialistic way. Right? And therefore, in the end, Krishna just says, okay, you want that instead of me, take it. Right? Because offense to Krishna means materialism. See, the first offense against the holy name means to blaspheme the devotees. It means self-aggrandizement at the same time. I want my reputation, I mean, I'm criticizing others to, you know, because I'm into self-aggrandizement, right? So if we look at the 10 offenses, we can see that they're all displaying a materialistic mentality. So Krishna just simply, at one point, to an offensive person, say, okay, you want that? Go for it. We see many examples of those who engaged in offenses. They lost taste for Krishna. Offenses take away our taste for the service to Krishna, and then our material desires will emerge and will come out again. We see the example of Subhara Muni, who offended a Vaishnava and then fell down from his yogic processes with 50 princesses, right? So, like that, there are many examples. But the principle is the devotional creeper becomes covered and then the material creepers emerge. And Krishna sanctions that. It's like when someone walked away with 25,000 rupees from the ashram of Srila Bhakti Siddhanta from Gaudiya Math, and he said, good. You know, or good. He said, this person, he got what he wanted, right? Krishna gave it to him. Krishna gave him Maya. That's what he wanted. Then Krishna gave it to him, right? But he didn't get Krishna. Right? So Krishna fulfilled his desire and gave it to him. So like that. What was what? Very inspiration. He was just there at that occasion when this brahmana was offering a puja, and this brahmana spontaneously offered this puja,
And he did it so nice that Narada was there in the audience. Just, he was just there for the puja. And when he saw that how it was done, he just became overwhelmed. And he said, spontaneously said that. And then that you are the greatest recipient of the mercy of the Lord. And then the Brahmana said no. So it was the Brahmana who sent him somewhere else. And then from one person he was sent to the next. Yes.
After he heard that, he was also bitten by the snake. So.
Not immediately. So, you know, when you are actually... Yeah, so, see, sometimes we find that one book gives a little more detail about a particular pastime than we find. So in Bhagavatam, we basically see that Maharaj Pariksit, after hearing from Sukadeva Goswami, was sitting there facing the north, you know, and that suddenly from the brahmanas that were sitting there, the sages that were sitting on the first row, that this snake bird emerged because by mystic power he had taken the form of a sage, and he had been hiding in the audience, and suddenly he came out and just bit Maharaj Pariksit, who burned up in fire. Now, from here we understand that while he was waiting there, that actually during that time his mother came, right? And so we see this whole thing, how Maharaj Pariksit's mother came and just was explaining, had been contemplating that her son was leaving, and then and felt great sadness, but then she preached to herself, because, you know, how can I feel great sadness when he's such a pure devotee, etc. But I still feel sadness then again, she said, because, you know, my son is leaving. It's like, yes, I'm not like him. I don't have the same transcendental qualities he has. And she said, well, since he's my son, I should then hear from him. Right? And I should just ask him to enlighten me. Because that is the process recommended in the scripture. So therefore she went to him. Right? And therefore she asked him. And then he was thinking, well, there's not much time now. I can't repeat the whole thing. You know, so what shall I tell mom? Eh? And then he remembered this narration he also heard, Brihat Bhagavatamrita, which he basically spoke then to his mother, as this narration was originally told by to Janamejai, right? Any other? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Raj, you were talking about preliminaries for, like, attaining perfection. Getting Krishna pregnant. This morning you also said other things. You know, just now you said you can only get it through the mercy of pure devotion. You also said you have to, we all know that you have to first get Lord Nityananda's mercy to attain Bhakti Dhamma, and so you also said this morning that we have to establish the link with the fact of charity. So there's so many things said in the Shastras, and personally I just have trouble chanting a few rounds and offering my food. So, and on the other hand, it's still said that we can go back home, back to Kodas in one life. So
It seems like attaining love of God is a very long road, and with many peaks in between to cross and difficult. And that is true. So the path of sadhana bhakti is not just so easy. You know, it's not so cheap. We cannot just love our neighbors, like I said, you know, on command, right? It is a whole practice. We have to undergo a change of heart. So, how to get the change of heart seems to be a long, long way. Well, yes, but if we sincerely try to make that change, and we very much try, then we have hope against hope. It's called asabandha, It's referred to as asabandha in the scripture. Hope against hope, that somehow or other we still get the mercy of the Supreme Lord. Because Lord Chaitanya is so merciful, so we hope that if he sees at the end of our life that we've tried so much, and although we're not qualified, that he'll still give it to us and said, okay, you can go back to Godhead. You tried so much. And then, I've mentioned this in previous classes, we also have Prabhupada, right? We are part of Prabhupada's party, so that's an extra impetus, you know, like at that time when they are looking at our case, then they'll say, oh, this one, okay, yes, she can go because she's part of Prabhupada's party. Right? And we wouldn't, so, because Lord Chaitanya wouldn't want Prabhupada to be unhappy, and Prabhupada would not be happy if one of his party wasn't going back to the spiritual world. So that's our hope, yeah, that Lord Chaitanya cares so much about making Prabhupada totally happy, because Prabhupada cared so much about making him totally happy. And Prabhupada cares that all his followers go back to Godhead. Therefore, there's a good chance that just on the strength of that, we may go back to Godhead. And that's why Prabhupada said, if you just follow, you can go back in one lifetime. Asabandha, hope against hope. That's it. Okay, we've been sitting for a long time. So, I thank you all very much. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Srila Sanatan Goswami Ki Jai. Sri Priyat Bhagavatam Rita Ki Jai.